This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 5th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 95th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're in a hurry this week, listeners, as we've got so much packed into the show, we feel, rightly, that it's time to cut to the chase. Here's what to look forward to in the next hour. We'll get an exclusive interview with a solid gold Brazilian icon, musician and campaigner Gilberto Gil talks to Culture.
So we were sort of starting in England, you know, a whole thing that established the grounds for our contemporary cultural situation.
We'll speak to the musician and designer who's written an opera for the forgotten voices of prehistoric creatures. Yeah, you were going to do the same too, weren't you?
My work is about the border of science, and I believe that science can solve a lot of things, but not everything. And my project is about that. How can I use design when science is not enough?
And we'll go to Brussels to compare studios with a radio show dedicated to comic books. It's the home of Tintin, you know.
It's something really, really great. It's a really experimental thing.
Plus, we'll get a preview of this year's very promising Auckland Art Fair, find out why kids' books matter in New York, and get our ears licked by Colombia's brilliant Bomba Estéreo in session for us live here at Midori House this week. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. A track from this week's live Midori House session first. From Colombia, come Bomba Estéreo, one of my favourite albums of the year, is their Elegancia Tropical, mixing electro, space rock stuff and beguiling vocals courtesy of lead singer Lee. And here they are with Pa Respirar.
Digo la verdad, y que no quiero ponerme a pensar.
That was Bomba Estéreo with Para Respirar, and true to form, there'll be more audio joy from them later on in the show. Singer Gilberto Gil is Brazil's biggest musical icon. And he's not just a singer. For 5 years, Gil was Brazil's Minister of Culture, serving in the government of former President Lula from 2003 to 2008. He's just finished a documentary with director Pierre-Yves Bourgault called Veramundo. In it, Gil travels around the Southern Hemisphere, from South Africa to Australia and back to his homeland, meeting artists, society's margins, and exploring the themes of social exclusion and racial discrimination. It's out already in various parts of Europe and has just been released in the UK, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Gil before his recent headline set at the WOMAD Festival to find out more.
It is not a story about once upon a time. We don't like the story about once upon a time.
In a sense, I'm here looking for the traces of the similarity between us.
They wanted to have a conversational film about the questions raised by colonial times, by slavery, by exploitation, social unrest and social instability, and they've chosen the Aborigines in Australia, or the communities that were part of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and then some Indian tribes in the Amazon. And they asked me to propose the conversational elements for the different people in the film, and to have the music, to bring my music, and to ask some colleagues, musicians, you know, from Australia and South Africa and Brazil, to do the thing. We did. And we had a 2-month filming season. I went to Australia, went to South Africa, went to the Amazon, and some filming in Bahia, also in my hometown during Carnival. And then they brought the whole material to Switzerland, and they processed the material, and they got finally got a film.
During my life of growing up with only knowing the West, there was a very big hole, and there was a feeling empty and feeling lost.
When you're an Indigenous person from your country and you're led to a belief that you are no one, that is a terrible indictment of colonization.
And after being to all of those countries in the Southern Hemisphere with quite similar pasts, you know, because they're all colonized, did you feel a lot of similarities between Brazil, Australia, South Africa?
Sure. The British Empire in Australia and New Zealand, the Portuguese Empire in Brazil, the royal families, the royal houses, European houses that sponsored, I mean, those processes and the discovering and the bringing of technology to exploitation of the resources in those countries. The processes were very similar because they had the possibility of a great accumulation of wealth, but they had also injustice and social imbalance and social inequality and all those things. I mean, very similar for the three areas.
And at the same time, the film is very positive when talking about racial diversity and everything. And are you an optimist, Gilbert?
I am both. I am optimistic from a side and pessimistic from the other side, because from the optimistic side, I always believe that we are trying. As a whole humanity group, we are trying to get better, to develop. And from the pessimistic side, I'm not sure that we'll have time to get to a balanced situation that would enable us to go for a future with good prospects. So I am at the same time optimistic and pessimistic. But I still believe that we can make it here. Yeah.
Everybody's related. Everybody's family.
You are because I am. I am because you are.
And talking about problems in society, you know, Brazil actually has recently been, there's been a lot of protests. Do you see that as something positive, perhaps?
It's not necessarily positive. It's at least neutral. And it's not just happening in Brazil, it's happening everywhere, in Spain, in Turkey, in Arab countries, in Egypt, in the States with the Occupy movement, in Spain, everywhere. I mean, I used to say that there is a tiring there was a kind of little exhaustion, you know, to the whole civilizing thing. I mean, we've been accelerating too much in the late, at least 150 years, and we haven't been able to offer equal opportunities to everyone. So it's a little uncomfortable, the whole situation for the civilizing process globally.
And finally, Gilberto, I just want to ask this final question. We're here in England, and I know you came to London 69 after being exiled. How do you feel when you come back to England? What are your memories?
It's a good thing, like going these places and coming here for the festival. Great memories came up, you know. Like I was remembering the first time I went for the first Glastonbury Festival, for the first and the second edition of the Isle of Wight Festival, to the Bath Festival. I mean, those were events and happenings that were giving the pace for what came later, you know. So we were sort of starting in England, you know, a whole thing that established the grounds for our contemporary cultural situation. So for me, it's an interesting opportunity to have those memories and to go back to those, you know, ancient times and see the families, like the grandmas and grandpas, you know, here with the sons and the grandsons and the hippie society, you know, still living and perpetuating and, you know, and going ahead. It's a nice thing.
It's our call to say these things and write subjects that are bringing enlightenment to the people, making them aware where we come from, where we are now, so as to make love to the future.
That was Gilberto Gil speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Gil's new film, Veramundo, is out now in Europe. For more details, go to veramundo-film.com. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're crossing now into a prehistoric realm. We're about to meet a woman who's created an opera from the reconstructed voices of ancient creatures. A mammoth, an ambulocetus, or walking whale, and the terrifying-sounding entolodont, or terminator pig. All animals whose sounds haven't been heard for millions of years. Sounds intriguing, huh? Her name is Marguerite Rumeau, she's French, and she calls herself a speculative designer. She went about recreating the lost voices of these creatures through a mixture of research and imagination, producing beautiful sculptural and audio installations, alongside interesting collaborative works ranging from a book to a film to a remix project with Dutch producer James Zhu. The opera of prehistoric creatures is a haunting and beautiful soundscape which feeds our imagination about the world's ancient past. And keen to find out more about this fascinating project, producer Katie invited Marguerite into Midori House to explain how it all came together.
The idea was to resuscitate their sound by reconstructing their vocal tracts. But the problem was that since the vocal tract, so the lungs, trachea, larynx, vocal cords and resonance cavities are all made of soft tissue, they don't fossilize. So it was an enigma that I had to solve. Unfortunately, I couldn't solve it all with science because it's problematic on the scientific point of view. You know, you're talking about animals which used to live million and million years ago. As a designer, it was really exciting because actually I would have to reconstruct them all. So yeah, I use scientific facts, but also a lot of speculations, stories, rumors, you know, and design, of course. When I started, I had no idea this project would take me so long. I thought it would be pretty straightforward, actually, you know. I would find scientific data and I would 3D print that, you know, and it would be my sculptures and I would throw compressed air through these shapes and it would make sound. But actually, it was even more exciting than that because, again, this data didn't exist, so I would have to reconstruct that completely.
And how did people first react when you told them that this is what you wanted to do?
I mean, it depends on who. A lot of people were actually really excited about it, but didn't really know how I would do that. I started to email a lot of different experts. So maybe now I've been in touch with more than 100 different experts. So paleontologists, explorers, people who are specialized in vocal cords, surgeons, many different people. Some of them were very excited by the project and told me to keep going, you know, even though it would be a tough journey. Some of them said, you know, it's impossible to do that. Again, as a scientist, it's maybe hard to conceive this idea, but as a designer, it's really exciting.
You say you talked to lots of different scientists and historians. What was the process beyond that? What did you have to do to then make these objects?
So there are different parts in the sculptures. There are the resonance cavities, the larynx with vocal cords, then the trachea and the lungs. So four different parts. For the resonance cavities, so I'm talking about the inside of the nose and the mouth of these creatures. It was the first thing I worked on. So for that, I had to gather MRIs from the closest living descendant of each of these animals. So it was already a quest in itself, because for the mammoths, I had to find the scans of an Asian elephant. Not so many elephants die every day, and not so many actually fit in a scanner as well. So, you know, I had to find this data first. And then I also had to find the skull of the ancestor, so of the extinct creature. And there was then a work of redesign of this MRI data inside of the skull of each of the extinct creatures. The sound comes from the vocal cords, which are inside the larynx. The problem with the larynx, and the reason why it took me actually a lot of time to solve this problem, is that there are not so many bones around the larynx, so I really had to make it up in a way, which was actually really interesting, because for the resonance cavities, I was actually quite close to the original creatures, but for the larynx, I also had to accept that this data is just gone, you know, forever, and maybe with design, I could actually redesign something that would actually have exactly the same function, make sound, but not the same shape. So that's what I did. So they are entirely redesigned with acrylic tubes and silicone and latex made from the right thickness and elasticity. And they are stretched. So when the compressed air is actually comes inside the trachea and all the way up to the vocal cords, they start vibrating. And then for the lungs, I worked with experts in compressed air, and we worked together in order to get the right pattern in terms of breathing, but also roar making, because it's all about the roar. So
it's really complex, isn't it? I wonder, how much do you consider yourself an artist or a designer, and how much a scientist? And how closely do you think those two things are interlinked?
I mean, for me, it's really clear that I got advices from scientists, but I'm not a scientist. And my work is, again, about the border of science. And I believe that science can solve a lot of things, but not everything. And my project is about that. How can I use design when science is not enough?
How did you feel when you first heard your creations make a sound?
Actually, it's really great you asked me that, because it was very magic, actually. I remember for the mammoth, it was the first animal I reconstructed, and it was like the day before the opening of my graduation show at the RCA. And I had a couple of people helping me, because in the last weeks, we were a big team working on that mammoth. And the first time we actually switched the compressor on and we started to hear the mammoth, I thought, yeah, I'm talking about something supernatural happening. This is really happening. I mean, it's really actually weird and unsettling. I think that was my concern, to create an unsettling experience.
And let's talk about you as a designer, because this isn't just a kind of audio project, is it? I mean, everything I've seen related to it is really visual as well. So the parts of the animals that you see are really beautiful kind of sculptures, really. You've had work published in magazines, there's a book related to it, there's artwork to go with the work you did with James Zhu, who kind of remixed some of the sounds. So how much is it a kind of visual thing for you, and what does it look like?
So the sculptures, for me, I treated them like ghosts. For me, this project is like a film. It's almost like an adventure or science fiction film, but made with design. It's about the experience of a ghost in space and how do you create that. So yeah, the sculptures themselves, I think, are quite beautiful.
Wow, that sends a shiver up the spine. That was Marit Humeau talking there to producer Katie. Her work is currently on display as part of a travelling show called The Universal Addressability of Dumb Things, which will be at the Dillawar Pavilion in England's Bexhill on Sea until the 20th of October. A great reason to visit one of England's best museums and buildings. As Katie implied there, though, there are many facets to this project. So to find out more, just visit Marit Humeau with an H.com. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back to the future next as we look ahead to the Auckland Art Fair.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Etiseta is special for its wide array of waves, beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Etiseta in the Films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we're off now to New Zealand. The Auckland Art Fair will open its doors to the public on Wednesday, with representatives from around 40 galleries descending on the Kiwi shores for an event that, every other year since 2005, has managed to increase its ticket and art sales, as well as gather a lot of media attention. To find out more about this year's event, Federico Monsalve met with Deborah White, owner of White Space Gallery, co-founder of the art fair, and this year's programming director. They sat down in the stock room at White Space to chat about what exactly is making international collectors stop and take notice of the Kiwi art scene.
The Auckland Art Fair was established in 2005, and it was a group of like-minded people who came together initially to discuss ways of promoting the visual arts in New Zealand better. Most of the galleries that were part of this group had participated in art fairs internationally. I had been involved with the Melbourne Art Fair on 4 different occasions, the Los Angeles Art Fair and the Glasgow Art Fair. We started off with only 15 galleries, and we were in a temporary structure down in Britomart, which was basically a large tent. It was a fantastic success. Everybody loved it, and the naysayers who refused to participate all wanted to take part in the next event, so that was really exciting.
What have been the major changes to the fair since it started in 2005?
Growth is the obvious one. It's now 40 galleries. I think in the first fair, we probably only had 2 Australians. Now we have 6 Australian galleries, and we could potentially have a lot more.
There was a recent article in Art Market blog which analysed the conditions in the local art scene and claims, and I'm quoting here, "New Zealand is ready for an art market boom." Do you think that's the case?
I really, really hope it's true. What I have noticed, because I've been in the visual arts community for a long time, is the increase in international collectors looking at New Zealand art. And I think perhaps one of the reasons is that the quality of the art that is made here is exceptionally good, but globally the price is so reasonable. You know, for an American or a collector from the UK to look at purchasing work here, the dollar exchange and the value of the work here is just such a bargain. And I don't know whether that drives it, but I do think that it comes back to having the work that's has integrity and is of good quality. And we certainly have that. And I think with our artists increasingly exhibiting and in some cases living part internationally and part in New Zealand, their work is just really appealing to an international collector now, much more than it ever has been before. So whether that creates a boom, I don't know. But as I say, I hope that it does.
Has there been an increase in New Zealand galleries participating in overseas events? Are locals tapping more into that art fair circuit?
I think it's like everything. It hasn't just happened overnight. It's built on the back of galleries, established galleries, well, like Gough Langsford Gallery, for example. Gary Langsford has been attending art fairs overseas for 15 to 20 years, long before Creative New Zealand decided that it was a good idea to fund these things. And for myself, I've been going to art fairs internationally and self-funding all of those events. And I think that has built a platform whereby New Zealand galleries are probably understood and accepted and recognised internationally now. And now it's fantastic that the government has finally come to the realisation that maybe presenting the visual arts internationally is just as important as the All Blacks. and is offering some support. It's still quite limited support, but there is some support now. And I think for a lot of the galleries, they get half their stand or something like that paid for it. And so we do have galleries going to Hong Kong. I think we had Stark White and Hopkinson Mossman go to Hong Kong Art Fair. So we're starting to get more of that international traction further afield, not just Australia, because we all do Australia all the time. You know, that's just going to the South Island, really, with a bigger audience.
Exactly. Yeah.
There is a resonance about the work that people from New Zealand make, and that's apparent in our fashion, in our film, and in our artwork. And it has quite a unique voice, and I think it is really compelling. And a part of that is, I think, a spiritual quality of people who live here and a connection with the land, concern for the environment. And at the same time, now, a level of sophistication about the way they make work. And I do think that goes across a lot of different media, and it's a very exciting time. I look at people like Ralph Hotory and some of those remarkable large panels that he painted, and how you can immerse yourself in them, and just they're just incredible. And they say so much about what it is to be a New Zealander. And there's a lot of artwork here that speaks to people like that, and I think it's a really good time to be an artist in New Zealand. The opportunities internationally are great.
That was Deborah White, co-founder and programming director of this year's Auckland Art Fair, which starts on Wednesday and runs until Sunday. If you fancy popping along, visit artfair.co.nz for more details. Still to come in part two, more from the wonderful Bombay Stereo in session for us here at Midori House. We'll meet the artist bringing Belgium's visual comic book culture to the radio, and we'll hop over to New York City to find out why children's books matter at a new exhibition, as if you needed reminding. Well, first up, some more tonic for your ears and your soul, and maybe your dancing shoes too. This is Bombay Stereo performing for us here at Midori House with Pajaros.
Solo sentí. Son mis sentimientos que llevo dentro. Mis sentimientos que llevo dentro. Son mis sentimientos. Solid.
I'm joined by Lee and Simon from Bombay Stereo, all the way from a country that we cover musically on the radio more than many people would think, which is Colombia and Bogota. But you guys are from the coast, right? You're not from Bogota. Where does the sound of the band come from? Or is it a bit of everything?
Well, actually, we're from both places, no? I'm from Bogota. Liliana's from the coast, so it's like a mix.
It's a happy accident.
Cold and hot.
Yeah, okay, this is what happens.
Then
there's beautiful musical rain happens, right? Hot and cold meet and something gorgeous happens. The new record is called Elegancia Tropical. Did the name come after the record, or do you kind of riff on something that's got that kind of tropical sound?
It came after.
Yeah.
It was like when we had like a basic idea of what we wanted, like make a tropical album but with a different perspective. So we just put the elegance.
We'll just say, we'll call it elegant, right? We'll call it elegant, and people will just have to follow.
Yeah. we usually, you know, make the music and all the things and the words came at the end.
Yeah. And that's how you guys write. You kind of write your riffs, because there's quite a lot of, I can see you guys have a spiritual kind of togetherness on stage, right? You're all kind of playing your instruments, but there's very much a vibe. A lot of people, a lot of music writers have described your music as the folk meets electro, cumbia and Colombian sort of traditional music meets electronic stuff. But what was on the radio? What were you listening to when you were kids for this happy accident to happen?
Well, a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
You know, in Colombia, you can hear from cumbia to heavy metal and rock and salsa, and it's like a very wide
spectrum.
We have this traditional music that is like our music, the Colombian music, but we have influence from all the world, especially from the States. No?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
it's a pity, but...
Yeah. It's a pity that it's coming down from the United States.
We have also influence from Europe, but especially from the States, because it's closer, no? It's closer, a lot of influence from Mexico. So you put on the radio and you can hear from salsa to, I don't know, a rock band and then some electronic DJ.
Yeah.
And then so we kind of grew up with that information.
So you can buzz through the radio dial and hear all this kind of stuff. And it feels like you can feel a bit of that in your music. I'm not accusing you of having a Bon Jovi CD in your collection, Simon and Lee. I'm just saying that there is a little bit of that rock vibe, obviously, in there as well, right?
Yeah, it's influenced from everywhere, you know?
Yeah. And you guys tour a lot. Your live shows are amazing. The one you put on for us in there, some of our audience are a little bit shy, but you kind of won them around, obviously. But you tour a lot, don't you? You play a lot of gigs a year. Your live shows are quite famous. How do you prepare for a show? Do you have to kind of get into the vibe? How do you do it?
Well, we like to drink whiskey.
Good.
A
lot of whiskey. Is it good for the voice? Whiskey, is it good for the voice?
Yes, it's good for everything. A mezcal.
Can you gargle with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But not with a worm, no?
You've got to watch out for the worm in the bottom, right? That's your dinner. And what about the crowds in the different countries? I mean, your home crowd, obviously, they dig it to a certain extent, and in Spanish language crowds dig the music, but it's got such a vibe, it's very irresistible. It kind of feels to me that you don't necessarily have to follow all the words. Sorry, Lee. But it's very much, it's nice, it's great music to dance to. It must be a great festival favourite, right?
Yes, I think it's the African influence to the music.
Yeah.
No? Like, it's like universal language.
It's got
like
that.
Everyone understands it, and it's linked to all kinds of dance music. So you just play it and the people feel it.
Yeah.
Like the beats, no? It's with the beats and with this part of the body.
It's down in your diaphragm,
yeah,
right?
And then
it's down
people
in your
don't
knees.
Need to understand the words. It's like, whatever. But with the music, the dance, it's dance music.
That was Simon and Lee from Bombay Stereo talking to me there. And the band are currently on tour across Europe. Just visit bombaestereo.com for more details and buy that record, Elegancia Tropical. It's one of the best of the year so far. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Up next, release your inner child. We're talking comics and children's literature.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we're stopping for a moment in Brussels. You don't often hear Belgium and innovation in the same sentence, but the Belgians did invent the speech bubble and gave us Tintin. And one young publishing house in Brussels is giving airtime to a new generation of Belgian comic artists through a radio show dedicated to le neuvième art, or the ninth art, as comics are regarded there. Always lovers of a good radio show here on Culture, we wanted to find out more, so we dispatched reporter Ian Wiley on the tram in Brussels to meet two of the presenters of Radio Grand Papier.
Can I be the only journalist inspired to become a reporter by a comic book character? The boy with quiffed hair and plus fours?
Hergé's Adventures of Tintin!
Brussels earned the title Capital of the Comic Book in the 1920s, when Belgian artists, both Flemish and French-speaking, blazed a trail of innovation, inventing the speech bubble, as well as a drawing technique called ligne claire, or clear line, which shifted comic books from cartoonish blobs of colour to a sharper kind of realism with fast-moving narratives. But while comic strip characters like Spirou and Lucky Luke still have a faithful domestic following, most of the Belgian publishing houses have been bought up by multinationals. Tintin and his Belgian comic strip friends have been left behind by edgier comics. First from France, then manga from Japan, and more adult-oriented graphic novels and reportage-style strips from the United States.
On l'appelle Lucky Luke, de l'Est au Far West. Il arrive au galop, le cowboy hero.
But a new wave of young Belgian artists is beginning to emerge.
Bonsoir à tous et à toutes, bienvenue sur Radio Grand Papier, émission de bande dessinée sur Radio Campus, la radio de la communauté...
Radio Grand Papier is a monthly two-hour live radio broadcast, a collaboration between Brussels Free University and L'Employé de Moi, a small comic art publishing house. It really shouldn't work, a radio show about a very visual form of art. But in the 3 years since launch, Radio Grand Papier has persuaded most of Belgium's leading comic artists, and many internationally renowned artists too, to discuss in detail their work on the programme.
And this collection is called We All Go Down.
In his apartment in the Bohemian Saint-Gilles quarter, Stéphane Noël, a comic artist and one of the Radio Grand Papier presenters, is showing me some of his favourite comics by young Belgians.
It's a very different to make an ugly drawing of something beautiful. This is a good drawing of something really nasty, like a close-up on a tongue on an ice cream with somebody sweating, you know, it's completely horrible.
According to the Belgian Comic Strip Centre, around 800 professional comic artists currently live and work in Belgium. Some of the new wave, such as Brecht Evans, who works in watercolours and whose illustrations adorn walls of buildings in Antwerp, are beginning to gain international recognition, and Radio Grand Papier is helping by encouraging, promoting, and occasionally challenging this community of Belgian comic artists.
It's important to get the voice of people that are drawing. Sometimes they are really shy people, but we are there to show them that we know their work, that we find interesting this point and this point, and we get sometimes really touching interviews.
Nicolas Verstappen co-hosts the show and says the programme has become required listening for Belgian artists.
Most of the artists we are meeting already know the show because, you know, when you are an artist, usually you listen to music. To be a comic book artist is a job you're doing usually alone in a room for all day long. You are just drawing and listening to music.
They want to be connected to others through their work. And the radio gives this simple opportunity to hear somebody talking about your work.
Bonsoir Tali.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir Nicolas. Nicolas ne répond pas, Nicolas.
But isn't it almost impossible to describe comic art on radio?
It's been really difficult at the start to do a radio show about comics because radio is only sound and comics is everything but sound. So you have to be learning to describe a book. You have to make the listener feel what the drawings are looking like, which is so difficult because you say, yeah, there is you using some pencils and it's really precise, or you have to discover to explain drawings only with the sound of your voice, which is something difficult. You have to find reference and say it's look a bit like Hergé, or it looks a bit like Crumb, or, and it's something really, really great. It's a really experimental thing.
Just as importantly, says Stéphane, the radio show provides a forum for critical analysis.
There is a lack of criticism about comics in Belgium, in France, and I think elsewhere too, because most of the time, people that are talking about comics just say, this book is just out right now, and it's beautiful, and it's that soul. And so people that write or think or have a look with an adult point of view on comics are quite rare. And so the only fact that we did this radio broadcasting makes us important, in fact. So we don't want to be the one to do it, but nobody else do it, so we have to do it.
Stéphane and Nicolas can't turn back the clock to the 1970s, when Belgian artists like Giger, Willy van der Steen and Mark Sleen were drawing 80% of all comics in Europe. But Radio Grand Papier is a chance for a new generation of artists, such as Noémie Mercier and Max de Rodriguez, to put Brussels back on the comic strip map. For Monocle, in Brussels, I'm Ian Wiley.
And if you're interested in listening to any of those radio shows about comics, then visit radio.grandpapier.org. Right, we're moving to the east coast of the US now, but continuing on a theme. From comics, we move to children's literature. Who can forget their first books and the colourful characters that came alive through the pages? Some taught us invaluable lessons, like how to tie our shoelaces or why not to hit our classmates. Others were more poetic and transported us to faraway lands. The impact of these books is what Leonard Marcus, historian and critic, set out to explore in a new exhibition entitled The ABC of It, Why Children's Books Matter, at the New York Public Library. Placing children's literature in the larger context of the arts, popular culture and social history, the show highlights different visions of childhood and how each inspired a new kind of book for the young. Leonard revealed all to our New York researcher, Pauline Eiferman.
I've written many books on the subject, so the library knew about me, and when they decided they wanted to have a show about children's literature, they asked me if I would like to curate it, and I said yes. And they essentially gave me the keys to the kingdom of the library, all the special collections, not just the children's book collection, which itself is like one of the best in the world, but the idea of the show was to put children's books in the larger context of the arts, popular culture, and social history, by drawing on materials from collections not focused on children's books per se, as well as the collection of children's books, in order to show how children's books connect up with other kinds of literature and art and historical artifacts.
And so how many books did you have access to when you started working on this?
Oh, probably millions, you know. I'd say there are 8 or 9 really significant collections of literature and various forms of art at the library here. And, you know, 12,000 children's books are published in the U.S. every year these days. So just gives you a sense of the scale of what might have been chosen for this show. There are about 250 books and objects in the show in all, the oldest of which is from the 17th century and the most recent from last year. And the books come from all over the world. The first part that we're coming to looks at different historical ideas of childhood and how each of these ideas led to a different tradition of children's books. And the very first thing you see over here makes the contrast very vivid, because it puts the New England Primer, which is a book of Puritan New England based on the assumption that children are born in sin with and in need of salvation, spiritual salvation, puts that next to William Blake's Songs of Innocence, which is a book based on the idea that children are spiritually enlightened from birth. This is another way of sort of idea of childhood. It's the citizen child, and these are books from all over the world which were published in order to create a sense of national identity in children. And very often you find books of that kind associated with the aftermath of big changes, revolutions, and other cultural upheavals. So for example, over here are books from right after the Russian Revolution. This one, and this one. And, you know, Russia saw itself as a modern new society, trying to shed the past. So they were fascinated by machinery, and here in a very fanciful way, this robot is taking a boy on a tour of a book factory. But this is very sci-fi looking, and I think just irresistible. Yet another idea of childhood is the view created by the progressive educators. Bank Street felt that modern children were interested in the modern world as opposed to the once upon a time world of fairy tales. They tried to generate a new literature for young children that was rooted in everyday experience. And so that, for example, The Great Green Room of Goodnight Moon is all about the ordinary things that a child would find in their room, but the idea was that a child would find that significant and thrilling in a way to see that reflected back in a book.
And this isn't the first time that the New York Public Library looks at children's books, correct?
No. The last show on the scale took place in the mid-1980s. And that, in a way, was a different era in the sense that there wasn't very much appreciation of children's books by the museum world and the world that of people who would go to see art at a museum or would associate children's books with the literature that they read in college, let's say. A lot of that has changed in the meantime.
And this exhibition kind of connects the dots between what we read when we are young and what we read when we're older and maybe the decisions that we make for our own children, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it sort of raises the question and traces the argument about what is a good children's book and how that's been played out repeatedly over hundreds of years by people in many parts of the world. And as you know, W.H. Auden, the poet, said in a quote which appears at in the introduction to the show as a whole, there are no good books which are only for children.
That was Leonard Marcus talking to Pauline Eiferman, and the new exhibition, The ABC of It, Why Children's Books Matter, is on at the New York Public Library until March next year, so plenty of time to take a peek if you're planning a trip to the city. And I'm afraid that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be delving into the pages of the new issue of Monocle via a new bookstore in Vancouver and a TV industry conference in Brazil. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and the real star of the show, as ever, was Holly Fisher with her mixing fingers. If you want to compliment us or query our taste, we're available 24/7, just try it, on RB, KB or HF at monocle.com. And it wouldn't be the Culture Show without a bit of music to say goodbye with. So our final treat from this week's Midori House session, courtesy of Colombia's Bomba Estéreo, from their wonderful album Elegancia Tropical, this is El Alma y El Cuerpo. Thanks for tuning in.
Y Thank you.